people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fallen down key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the end of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people, the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is the ethnostate that we recorded this week. That was, of course, our chief host, William Johnson, the chairman of the American Freedom Party, our producer, Ken Givenan, myself, Paul Fromm from Canada, and this week, two special guests, Pastor Tom Robb and Rachel Pendergraft from Harrison, Arkansas. And, more refugees are coming and other stories.
Hello, everyone. This is William Johnson, chairman of the American Freedom Party, here for another edition of the Ethnostate. With us, we have Ken Givenan, Paul Fromm, Rachel Pendergast, and Pastor Tom Robb. Thank you guys for showing up. As you guys know, I'm in Los Angeles. And whenever a celebrity comes to town, whenever Donald Trump or Obama, they just close down all the roads. Well, we had the Golden Globes here a couple of days ago, and they shut down more roads. It was so hard to get around. But are any of you guys familiar with that, with the brouhaha that arose around the Golden Globes with that the host?
I can't remember his name.
Ricky Gravis or something like that.
Gravis or something.
Yeah. What do you guys take?
Comedian from England.
Yeah, I listened to that. I didn't want to listen to it at first, but everybody was commenting on it. So I listened to it, and he was kind of, you know, foul mouthed. But the things he said, boy, it sure struck a nerve with much of the population of America.
What did he say?
He lectured.
He's basically, Hollywood elites are a bunch of turds.
Yeah.
But
He lectured. He's been up there. He says, you know, I've been the host of the Golden Globes for this is my eighth time, and, you know, I'm going to say some things that you guys aren't going to like, but I don't care anymore. He says, just joking, I never cared. And then he starts in, and he says, well, first of all, the last thing he says, look, you guys are going to get up here. This is 3 hours long. And when you get up here, just thank your agent, thank your God, and sit down. Don't try to lecture us on political stuff, because most of you haven't even been to as much school as Greta Thunberg has been to. And he says, look, you know, this time, I know you guys are all a bunch of pedophiles, and all the shows that you produce are a bunch of pedophiles, because, I mean, listen, this show that was a pedophile in there, this show had a pedophile in there, and he says, and then, of course, the two popes. Everybody laughed on that one. And then he went on and says, but he says, and this show lasts for 3 hours, and it's as dull, it's even duller as a show that I'm on. I'm on a show about a guy who's contemplating suicide because his wife is dying. And spoiler alert, there's going to be a second episode, a second year, a second season, so that means I didn't commit suicide. Just like Jeffrey Epstein. And so everyone go, boo, boo. He says, hey, look, I know you guys are all friends with him, and you're all sad because you now have to fly in your own planes. But he just went on and on and just criticized these guys for basically the holiday elites for embracing their left-wing views. And everybody has been commenting on that. And I listened to it a couple of times, and it was really entertaining, and I think it really struck a chord. So many people are upset with what these Hollywood elites have been doing. So
the best part about
it
is
did he finish the show out?
And not only did he finish the show out, but it was all on teleprompter, so they knew ahead of time what he was going to say, and they allowed him to say it. And on top of that, whenever he would take a dig at, like, Tom Hanks, they focused in on Tom Hanks. They knew who to focus in on ahead of time. So it was he passed it by and it was approved. So they knew what was going on.
Maybe they just had to spice up their ratings a little bit or something.
That is media buzz. That's a good example of getting attention. So he made that up by design. But
yeah.
I think actually
he may not be invited back for a ninth run on that. And my wife said that even Clint Eastwood got up and made a few comments that weren't so favorable to the Hollywood elite.
Okay, I didn't watch the show.
She saw that in the news. You know,
I was just upset that I couldn't drive down. I was upset that I couldn't drive down the streets, and I didn't care about it. And then when everybody's talking about what this Ricky Gravis said, I had to watch it. But can you start to say something, the best part, and then I cut you off.
Well, the best part about it was the face of Tom Hanks. He looked like he was mad. Maybe he's just putting on, I don't know, but if you look at the face, it was the guy's name, Robert De Niro, whatever. It was like they were trying to fake a laugh or a smile, but they really didn't like it.
Oh, a lot of them were uncomfortable. Okay.
Maybe the audience didn't know. Maybe it was just a teleprompter guy and a couple of cameramen.
Could be.
Yeah,
but what's interesting about that crowd, if you go online and look at the photographs, they're basically all white people.
Oh, that's another thing he said. He says, you know, we usually do an in memoriam of all the people that have died in our academy. Well, I'm not going to do it this year because I looked at it and everybody that died was white. Next year, I hope we have fewer white people die, or something like that. As an employee, more non-whites die, and that was the implication. And so it was really edgy. But in any event, let's get down to more important things, like the rise in racism perplexes England's primary schools. Give us the skinny on that, Ken.
You know what's interesting about this story is I did not know that in England there are such a thing as a racism register. This is the first time I ever saw this. So I don't know if this is a local thing, if it's a national thing, but I guess if you're a racist, they put you on a registry like you are a child molester. But the story is, there is a 40% increase in incidences of children being punished for doing things that are racist. These are primary kids. These aren't high school kids. I don't know what they call high school in England, but the equivalent. But these are primary kids. I mean, these are the little ones. So the story says that there were 350 exclusions. I guess that's their term for suspensions. 206 to 207, but 217 to 218, it jumped to 496. My takeaway on this is a couple things. Number one, I'm not sure that the kids are getting more racist. I think what is happening is the administrators are finding more racism because they find it everywhere they look. But what's more is I think there's more brown people there. So that probably accounts for some of the rise as well. But, you know, little primary kids, they're brainwashing them. It's disgusting.
Well, you know, I think we need to analyze this more closely because I've never heard of a racism register. But maybe it's kind of like a bridal register. If you're registered, then you get gifts. Maybe that's what it means.
I don't think that nationally there is a so-called racist register, but I do know that a few years ago, the school system did implement a registry in the school, and it is primary, but also does include middle and high school years. And the bad thing about that is it follows you throughout your school career and then can follow you then to future employers and colleges and so forth will have access to that. And I think, like one of you mentioned, I think it's primarily because there is such an influx of Muslims into the country and they are so hypersensitive, and then you have your liberal wives who are trying to pander to them. So they're basically seeing any nonchalant, even non-racist type gestures or attitudes or ideas or maybe a paper that has been written or a story or essay by a young child that perhaps doesn't actually glorify Muslims during Quran studies in the classroom, and that could get them on the registry. So it's a very dismal plight these youngsters have, that they can have something like this added to their school record.
Well, you know, nowhere in the story does it say that only white kids are being punished, but I can almost guarantee you probably 99% of them.
I think when you've got a couple of factors here. You've got very, very left-wing teachers, white, and they want a virtue signal. So what better way than to punish some little white kid for the wrong word? So they'll be very vigilant doing that. So that could account for an increase in the numbers. For instance, if small towns police spend twice as many hours with their radar box this year than last year, they might report an increase in speeding. All it means is they've issued more tickets. There may not be an increase in speeding. There's an increase in enforcement. I see that happening, and of course it's small hanging fruit. Beat up on a white kid, no problem, but deal with some of these substantive problems in the education system, like the grooming of white girls to be prostitutes and by the Muslim gang. Boy, that's too controversial. Don't want to touch that stuff.
And I don't remember the exact details, but last year, in the early part of the year, there was actually a teacher that in a more of a rural school that was called before the school administration, and she was actually punished because some Muslim parents had come forward and said that she had failed in her classroom to properly discipline a white student who had made fun or something of Islam during one of their holy days. And she said it was no big deal. Everything had been handled properly and so forth. It was just a very minor instance. But some of the parents had come forward, and so she was punished by the administration for not doing more. So it's also possible that some of these school teachers who may look the other way or see nothing of it, it's just schoolyard banter, some of them may have decided to step forward rather than risk their school careers, which again is unfortunate.
But it also underscores...
Yeah, of course. I was going to say that, of course, it also sends a signal to people, too, that these teachers are doing their job, and it allows an opportunity for to spread guilt, you know, and dire warnings and increase diversity training in schools and so forth. Right. We have this increase in even in our younger schools. We need to address this issue to stamp this out while they're still little. And so I can see that we increase funding, increase diversity training, guilt trip being placed upon people. So whether an increase, even if there was not an increase, they might say there was just because of the fact of the not positive, but the benefits they have of helping spread the idea that there's racism.
How long would a conservative teacher last in that environment? I mean, they would be weeded out almost instantly.
Yeah, that's probably true. But more than weeding out the teachers, the effect that it's going to have on these young children, because like you said, Rachel, is that they're indoctrinated at an early age. And each one of us can think back, how were we indoctrinated when we were little kids? And I can think back, a lot of things that I do in my life is because of the indoctrination that I received when I was a child. Now, you know, I have a lot of animals on my farm. You have what's called imprinting, where you have a little baby chick will be born, and the first person the chick sees is a cat, it'll imprint on the cat, it'll pretend it's a cat this whole life, or things like that. Well, we have imprinting, and for example, whenever I hear even mild swear words, I don't like it, and I won't say it, because I was taught that. And like I remember when I was just a little kid, one of my teachers put a book on her head and was walking around with a straight posture. You should have a straight posture. And I think about that, oh, I gotta have a straight posture. And so, when you're a little kid, all these things get imprinted on your mind, and it's a hard row to hoe to change that opinion. And so these kids, you know, there's hope for the future generation, but it's going to be, they're going to have to overcome big obstacles because they're being indoctrinated like this from early ages.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Any other comment on this story?
Well, I just briefly, is that, you know, you mentioned about the indoctrination and how the imprinting and how, you know, there just really is this incredible amount of the propaganda indoctrination facing our youngest people. But one thing that, you know, Pastor Rob and myself, you know, for those that don't know, is my father. So anyway, something that, you know, he always kind of, you know, taught myself and my brothers and so forth just during leadership training was the fact that even though there's such an incredible amount of indoctrination against our young people and the enemy just pours and pours and pours it on them, at some point there becomes such a thing as like overload. And there's a lot of young people that, you know, they're going to succumb to that, but there's a whole nother portion of young people that are going to have, you know, almost like sensory overload. And at some point, they're just going to like throw off those things and look in a new direction and look for something different. And, you know, I think that's a great hope that we have for our people, that overload is just going to, you know, at some point it's going to be like they're just facing a brick wall and they're just going to not want to travel down that same path. They're going to look for something different. And I think that gives a great opportunity to white patriots or white nationalists and so forth, that we can offer them a new direction in life.
Case in point.
Absolutely. Even the most ardent liberal, you know, the most rabid liberal, knows not to get off at the wrong exit when they go through St. Louis or Chicago or Denver or Birmingham or Pittsburgh or Memphis
or Harrison, Arkansas.
There's no bad that exists in Harrison, Arkansas.
Okay.
But the most rabid liberal knows that.
Yeah. However, about reaching this wall or reaching this turning point, I think that my opening discussion regarding the Ricky Gervais and the Golden Globe Awards, it shows that we're reaching that point. Because a few years ago, you never would have had the groundswell of support for this Ricky Gervais. These social justice warriors would have booed him off the stage. And now, when they started to boo him, and he came back with a classic comeback, they all laughed, and they laughed embarrassedly. But then the audience really, or not the audience there, but the people who watched it on the TV audience, they were supportive of what Ricky said. So I think we're kind of reaching that point. So that's a good point.
I think Holy Weird has really lost a lot of credibility in the last couple of years with the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, and the other fellow, the guy who was in
court. Harvey Weinstein.
Weinstein, who, of course, was doing, I'm disabled now. He was hopping along this phony stuff. I think a lot of people are coming on. In the schools, though, and this is what I find hopeful, the contradictions between the official ideology of multiculturalism is wonderful, diversity is our greatest thing, and all this, young people, white people growing up in that, many of them see it. And some of the people of my son's generation who grew up in a multicultural cesspool are a lot more enlightened than some of their parents. They've seen it, and they've seen that what they're told are lies. Some believe the lies, but others don't. But one of my son's high school pals was a real liberal, and he was standing one day at a bus stop, and along him came a Negro on a bicycle, knocked the teenager to the ground, broke his arm, and stole his
yarmulke.
No, his wallet. What use is a yarmulke? Except, but anyway, after that, the kid was no longer a liberal, and he said to my son, "Why did he do that to me?" And my son said, "No reason. Just because he could, that's the way they are." and the other kid got it. And I think a lot of kids growing up in multicultural societies are seeing the lies they've been told and the contradictions, and they can check things out on the internet, and they can watch great enlightening shows like The Atmosphere.
One thing that you said...
Also, are you all familiar with Terry Gilliam? I think that's the name. He's a movie director and has made a huge number of movies. And he did an interview, I believe it was with Vice magazine a few days ago. And he stated there that he said, "I'm getting tired of white men being blamed for everything that's wrong in the world." And that's quite a statement from somebody of that position.
Well, you know, Ken, maybe we should move to another article to talk about. Which one do you think we should talk about next, Ken?
Let's talk about the Terry Gilliam article.
Okay, let's do that.
It's on the screen.
I didn't get into the story, so I had no idea.
Where great minds think of life.
It's all cold.
What is interesting about...
I never got the story, so I had no idea.
You did not get them. I sent them to you. So you must have took your spam.
You have a wrong email or something. I never got a link or anything.
We're getting a teen
echo.
We'll take care of it later.
Okay.
This guy, Terry Gilliam, 79 years old, hard to believe, but he is the one member of the Monty Python troupe who was an American. He began as a cartoonist, I guess it was funny, so they incorporated him in skits. But he said stuff like this before, but you know, if you couple this with the one with, what was that guy's name again, Garbus or whatever, you're starting to see a pattern, but if you want to get noticed, you got to stand up from the crowd. And the way to stand up from the crowd is to be sane for a change. These guys who are coming out supporting, you know, white Western culture, they're so contrasted to what the norm is that they can't help but stand out. Okay, here's the quote from Terry Gilliam. He says, "I understand that men have had more power longer, but I'm tired as a white male is being blamed for everything that is wrong with the world." This is during an interview, and says he threw up his hands and he said, "I don't get it. So just let me fill this tidbit at the end, this caveat, is I remember when I first saw Monty Python back in, early 70s, as a kid in high school. I didn't think they were funny. I thought it was the stupidest show I ever saw. But as I grow on it, then you start getting it. And they were funny.
But if you talk to their, ask their views back then, they would have been the hardcore leftists. You know, so some of them are coming around.
Well, that works with what we were talking about before. You know, people my age, the so-called boomers, when I was in high school, I didn't know anybody that was not a liberal. I mean, maybe in church, but in school, they were all leftists. Not anymore, they're all Trump backers. So, you know, people change.
Well, the circus master at Monty Python, John Cleese, who's just a gifted comedian, and he came out a few years ago saying that London wasn't London anymore.
Right.
It's been changed. So, and he was pretty hardcore about that. And that's within the last 5 years. I think people are changing. People who are perceptive and see the things around them are changing, are reacting, and not with just this silly celebratory diversity is our greatest strength on them.
Yeah. So we have to capitalize on that and make sure that we have influence and direct the change. But
I was just going to say, you know, so many of those young people during that age, you know, I think they're really rebelling against what they were being told was a hateful society. And, you know, we have to understand that having separate neighborhoods and separate communities and people being allowed to socialize and do business with and so forth with people of their own background doesn't make them hateful, doesn't make them monsters or anything like that. So they're rebelling against that. And in their mind, they saw this, you know, that they're part of a generation that was going to usher in some sort of utopia where everyone could get along. And instead, what they see is that wasn't the goal. People getting along was not the goal. The goal was white genocide. The goal was to end and destroy and dismantle Western civilization and to dismantle Christianity. And now they're seeing the fruit of all those ideas that they thought were going to help save America, and instead they see that it's actually destroying America and destroying Western civilization. And I don't think they ever thought that this is what they were working for. And now, you know, aghast, they look around and, like, you know, John Cleese, you know, had mentioned, Paul Fromm, he had referred to, did that interview with the BBC, and said, when I walk around London, I don't see anybody that looks like me. And, you know, that really is sad. I don't think they really realize they were an indoctrinated generation after World War II. Didn't recognize...
Well, you hear, speak about what you say there, Rachel. Even now, I hear so often people on the news reporters, Fox News, what I listen to mainly, and they make statements like, "said what has happened to the liberals? What has happened to the left? They used to be for free speech." I said, "No, they weren't. They were never for free speech. They just wanted to get the foot in the door." But they'll say, "Oh, they used to be for free speech. The liberals, the left, is not like they used to be." Yes, they are. They always were against
liberals. Pastor Rob. Something your daughter said, she says that these teenagers, all when they were younger, were rebelling against society. So my question is to you is, what did Rachel do to rebel when she was a teenager?
I think she probably drank too much soda pop. I don't know. I was, you know, I hear that, and I wasn't a rebel. You know, I'm going to show my ignorance here, but I don't even know what Monty Python is. You know, I hear about it, but I've never watched it, don't even know what it is. I was raised in a Christian home, and I folks associated with other Christians, and so I never stepped into the dark world of Monty Python.
Okay, question. You answered my question. What she did to rebel was she watched TV.
I listen to the 80s hair bands.
Okay, all right. But in any event, okay, let's move on. One thing you said, Paul, you said that you called it Holly Weird, and you said that Holly Weird is losing its influence. couple of days ago really brought that home, is because after we had this killing of this Iranian guy, by Donald Trump and his drone, one of the leaders of Iran came back and says, oh, Donald Trump is going to attack our cultural heritage sites. Well, you know, that's kind of one-sided, because we can't attack America's cultural sites because their culture is only Spider-Man and Wonder Woman. They don't have anything, any cultural sites that's real. And I thought, that was so clever of that Iranian guy to point that out. And it does show, even worldwide, Hollywood is getting a bad rap, and it's well-deserved.
Well, on the issue of the assassination of the Iranian general, I'm still of two minds, but I did, a friend of mine called me up just an hour before we went on the air, and he watches the news all the time. He said, did you see what happened at the funeral? I said, no. He said, well, there's a big stampede, and 50 Iranians got trampled to death. So Donald Trump's drone kills one person, and there's almost a war in the Middle East, but it's not unusual because of just the crazy cultural behavior for them to just to trample 50 at a funeral. It kind of makes you wonder.
Okay, now the reason why I said the reason why I segued to this is because I do want your opinions. You said, Paul Fromm, that I am of two minds, and that's kind of what I am, and I want to ask you guys what you think. But before I ask you, I do want to make a comment, is that I saw an aerial photograph of people turning out for that funeral, and the plaza was just packed. People couldn't even move, so I could see very easily if somebody tried to move in one direction, you'd knock somebody over and step on them. So I could see that there was really not much could be done to prevent that type of deathly situation, because people were packed in there so tightly. But the point is I want to know what your guys' opinion is of that attack against this Iranian leader. We'll start off with you, Pastor Rob.
So I am also of two minds. Part of me says I have no love for Iranian people. I care about my people. I don't want to be involved in their worries or concerns. I just assumed our troops were at home. I don't believe we should be involved in any foreign wars over there. So often when it seems like they are actually for the benefit of the false state of Israel. So I do believe that we'd probably be better off if we would just bring our troops back home, protect our borders like constitutionally we are mandated to do, protect our borders and our citizens. And if somebody steps over the line and attacks our nation, our schoolyards, our city park, then I say we should retaliate with all the muscle we have. So that's kind of my position. And so I don't see any benefit of our involvement over there. I did see where Netanyahu, who in Israel, who I believe probably is the instigator of many of the problems over there, stated that they want to stay away from the issue. It's American concern, American issue, and they don't believe that Israel should be involved. I don't think Israel should be involved. You instigators us put off. And so I do have two minds on that.
Okay, let's go on now.
Anyway,
Rachel.
I don't believe over there, but
okay, very good. Rachel, give me your thoughts.
Well, I have a similar opinion. I know many people in the white nationalist movement. I mean, when we go back to Desert Storm, when we go back to Vietnam, and every foreign war that the U.S. has been in, I think we all have kind of the same gut reaction. First off, I don't like to see the U.S. embassy or any U.S. soldiers or U.S. personnel being attacked. So I'm of the mindset of, yes, retaliate and let them know, hey, this is what you've brought on yourself. But then also, I don't want to see our soldiers, you know, killed. I don't want to see foreign wars for Israel or for any loss for any reason other than, you know, what is in the best interest of America. So I kind of the same mindset. But I would say that as far as, you know, right now for this instance, because they did attack the U.S. embassy, I would say, you know, go in there and with all the firepower you've got and end it. And, you know, I also want to put something out there. I know that, you know, we have, you know, since World War II and the bombing of Dresden by the U.S. and all the, you know, the killing of civilians, that we have these new games and protocols of war where we're supposed to go after, you know, just specific targets and so forth, leave the civilians alone and on. But we have Middle Eastern countries who have whole populations who are indoctrinated against the U.S., they're indoctrinated against Christianity and against Western civilization as a whole. They're moving in mass into Western nations. I think they all have the same mindset of destroy Christ, destroy Christianity, destroy Western civilization. So I don't think we should have any rules of war. When they all come out and decide that they want to destroy the U.S. and burn our flag, I think we should throw the war book out the window and bring some fire and brimstone on Iran and on any Middle Eastern country that wants to hurt or maim or kill our soldiers and U.S. citizens.
Okay. Ken, do you have anything to add to this?
Well, my thought is I think it's too early to tell because I was so pleased when Gaddafi got taken out, Saddam Hussein got taken out, but then you look at the aftermath of the big mess that was made as a result of that. So I had to do 180. And then if you look, where was this guy killed? He was killed in Libya, is that right? Or was he was in Iraq?
In Iraq.
Yeah, but he's Iranian. So these guys a few years ago were killing each other, and now they're buddies. Did we cause that? You know, are we bringing these people together? Maybe not by design, but it seems so. But my point is, let's wait and see what happens. But
right. And so, finally, Paul, do you have any further comments?
What troubles me is that General Soleimani played a big role in the defeat of ISIS. Now, I think defeating ISIS was a legitimate goal on our part. They're terrorists. Is that a good way to pay your ally back? I also look at it this way. General Soleimani was killed by an American drone in another country, in Baghdad, Iraq. What if the American chief of Joint Chiefs of Staff was killed by an Iranian drone, assuming they have one, in visiting Paris? I mean, people would be outraged. They'd say, one of our people killed on foreign soil. This is terrible. On the other hand, the Trump administration says that General Soleimani was planning attacks on American soldiers and civilians. I don't know if that's true. I know we were lied to about the Iraq war. We were told that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. It turns out he had nothing but 60s-era Soviet technology. That's what leaves me up in the air, but I come back pretty much with what Pastor Rob was saying. What the heck are we doing there, Army? I mean, what is America doing there? These are wars for Israel. I don't see any basic American interests at stake. There are American interests at stake, and you should have soldiers, you know, shoulder to shoulder on the Mexican border. That's where the invasion's coming from, and through the international airports.
I listened to the comments by our leading statesman, by far and away the number one person in our movement that is heads above everybody else in reputation and prestige, and he's totally one of us except for the race issue. And that's Donald Trump. Ron Paul. And if you listen to what Ron Paul said about, and he was kind of attacking Donald Trump, he says that we should not be over there at all. He takes our stand exactly. And then he put up on the bulletin board all of our bases all around Iran. And Iran is just a huge country. But if you look all around, surrounding Iran, we have all sorts of bases all around there. And so he was saying, Donald Trump attacked Iran because he was afraid for our safety. Look at all of our bases. It should be Iran that's afraid of us, not us afraid of them. And he says that, you know, economic sanctions is an act of war. We shouldn't be over there. We should bring all the troops home. And I truly think that Ron Paul is just an excellent statesman, except he's not one of us in the area.
John Craig Roberts put out a similar article within the last 24 hours.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Let's move on. Let's get back on point. Let's talk about the blacks are the most religious and the most wonderful, strike at, the most violent racial group. So tell us all about that, Ken.
This is an article I just stumbled across. I don't even know how I found it, but it was surveying the various ethnic and racial groups in the United States. So I pulled out the data from just three of them, blacks, Hispanics, or not Hispanics, but Asians and whites, but it didn't include Hispanics. But believe in God by race, blacks, 83% believe in God, relative to whites who believe, well, 61%. What about the importance of religion in one's life? Blacks say 75% of them say it's a big deal. 49% of whites. Then I scroll down here and let me take a look at one more. There's a lot of categories that survey these people, but this one I thought was important. Belief in absolute standards of right and wrong. This is one where blacks fell back. 36% of whites said yes, they believe in absolute standards of right and wrong, but blacks only 28%, which is very inconsistent, particularly with the Christian ethos.
Okay, my take on this, and I'll start off, is that this kind of underscores a very typical racial makeup of this group of people. Blacks tend to be more steeped in superstition and not as knowledgeable with regard to facts and science, so they would more naturally believe in voodooism, supernatural religion of whatever stripe, whether it's their own tribal religions or Christianity. They will embrace that because they would believe that over science, which is too complicated for many of their minds. But then they would not necessarily follow those tenets because that doesn't fit their genetic makeup. They think our religion is good, but it's not going to govern my life because I'm the carnal man. And then the fact that they're the most violent underscores that same propensity that's in their genes. That's my comment.
Who is next?
I
agree with you. I was a part of their propensity for religion, okay, because I understand the poll was testing to see how many of them are religious. And I don't know if it's religion so much as the community that they associate with. Their churches become a very focal point of their communities and their social activities and so on. And so they have the greater sense. White people are more independent. I mean, we go strike out and go our own way. Find more mountaintops to see what's on the other side, where blacks don't do that. And I think that comes back to the same area with religion. I think they feel like comfort of this community they have. And so they go to church for their potlucks and social activities, and therefore religion becomes a very important part of their social structure. Whether it's a deep faith or not, that's another story.
Well, I do believe it is a deep faith. Are you familiar with what's called a cargo cult?
Cargo cult.
Paul, why don't you tell us what a cargo cult is?
Well, if I recall correctly, a cargo cult is when a primitive people come in contact with a more advanced people and they find some object that's new, they seize upon it as something that could be worshipped. There's a movie called The Gods Must Be Crazy, and it's
that's what I was thinking of.
I believe it's set in Southwest Africa, and a plane flies over, and I think somebody drops a coke bottle, and it falls in the desert, and the Hottentots gather around, and they're amazed. This must be a gift from the gods. So I believe they worship the coke bottle. That's, I think, a cargo cult, but I may have it wrong.
What about you, Ken? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I actually did a story on cargo cults, but what happened is during World War II, the Americans would land on these remote islands, and these people did not know what they were seeing. They never seen an airplane before. They never saw any of this. So they assigned what religious people do, what they don't understand, they make up something. So they assigned it to some supernatural phenomenon, but then the war was over and these people left. So they tried to remanufacture what they saw, try to get the gods back to bring their stuff, you know, because of this manufactured goods. So they literally made airplanes out of sticks. You know, the Bible talks about wood, hay, and stubble. Well, this is a literal example of that. But, they made watchtowers, for the airplanes coming in, I forget what you call them. But they just took stuff out of the woods, whatever they could find, out of the bush. And they made airplanes. They made all kinds of things that they saw the Americans have drive. That's a cargo call. It's an imitation call. They're imitating something that is...
Yeah, real. See, what happened is, during World War II in New Guinea, they would bring all of these chips in there, and they had all sorts of cargo that would be given to these natives, and they'd, oh, this is from the gods. And so then they would pray to the airplanes that they made, hoping that the gods would bring this new cargo cult in. It's kind of like that discussion between cat owners and dog owners. The dog owner who has a dog, he says, the dog says, oh, this man feeds me, he shelters me, he takes care of me, he must be a god. And so the dog just treats the man like a god. And then the cat says, this man feeds me, takes care of me, watches over me, I must be a god. And that's what it goes on. But in any event, these cargo cult people in New Guinea, they had a true, sincere belief that if they would make these airplanes, that God, they worshiped the God, would bring the goodies again, the Hershey's and the Tootsie Roll bars, but that didn't happen. And then, but that is irrefutable truth. What the blacks have done is irrebuttable proof that God does exist. Because I know that God, that there is a God, and in some form or other, because I have a picture of my father shaking hands with God. I have a picture of my father shaking hands with Haile Selassie. And who is Haile Selassie? He's the God of the Rastafarians. So no one can tell me there isn't a God because my dad shook hands with him. For what it's worth. Okay. But in any event, on that stupid note, let's go to another article. Let's talk about what Missouri and the Missouri governor is doing to destroy our people.
What is troubling about this article is Donald Trump allowed virtually every jurisdiction, every state in the country to opt out of receiving refugees. Not one did. Not one single governor anywhere. However, there are a couple of governors who are playing this up a little bit, apparently for political reasons, and one of them seems to be the governor of Missouri. It's also true of the governor of Tennessee, both of whom, by the way, are Republicans. But Missouri's governor, Michael Parson, said that publicly that he would decline President Trump's offer that allows jurisdictions to refuse the settlement of alien refugees. Trump signed that executive order back in September, so a little bit bothersome that not one state. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories going out there. They're saying, hey, these guys are being influenced by George Soros, they're being pressured, maybe they're being paid off, they don't know. But a lot of people find it very strange that not one single governor anywhere has taken advantage of Donald Trump's offer.
Well, I think the main
reason... Arkansas is accepting them.
Oh, really?
Arkansas is accepting them, yes.
Yeah. I think that the main reason this is happening is what I guess I call the Gary Hart syndrome. Do you know, you guys remember who Gary Hart was, right?
Hart, yes.
He was governor of Colorado when he ran for president. And someone asked him, why did you enter politics? Do you know the answer? He entered politics because he says, well, I couldn't be a rock star and I wanted to get the girls. I wanted to be popular. I wanted to be popular. And so all of these governors, every single governor is a governor because he entered politics. And why did that era people enter politics? Because they wanted to be popular. They wanted people, look at me, vote for me, I'm an important guy. And what is the was the popular mantra of everything that happened up until the Golden Globes or Ricky Gervais stuck a pin in it? It was, you support the refugees, you support the liberal propaganda. So until we make it so it's popular to be our position, then the elect officials aren't going to embrace that.
Now, I thought I recall recall a couple of years ago that actually Texas for a while was fighting the refugee resettlement program and saying that they did not want any in the state of Texas, but they may have transitioned the governor since that time.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially with Missouri being right smack dab in the middle of the heartland, that's a really dangerous precedent for other especially rural white areas to follow suit. And, you know, I think some of it may have to do with any type of federal kickbacks and money and so forth that they get for being locations of resettlement.
Yeah. Well, what we need to do, see, all of the immigrants that are coming here because they want to immigrate here. And they are invited here by a large number of white people. So when the tide turns and white people feel comfortable saying, no, we want to have our own country, we want to have our own ethnostate, and then couple that with a lot of the non-white people who say, you know, that's not such a bad idea, then maybe the trends will change and the elected officials will see it a different matter. But until then, you can just expect this from every elected official, from the top to the bottom.
And by the way, they have a January 21st deadline to get this done.
Okay, all right, go ahead. Paul, go ahead.
Well, I'm puzzled because the electorate in many of these states would be fairly strongly supportive of, say, no more refugees. I suspect what these politicians are afraid of is that while they know a lot of people would be on their side, they're going to get flailed by the liberal media, and they don't want that.
They want to be popular.
Yeah, they want a nice warm fuzzy, even if the people back home don't actually support them. They say, yeah, no more refugees.
Yeah. Okay, Pastor Rob, your turn.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a lot of our influence by the religious background, you know, they feel that it's a Christian duty, an obligation to help the refugees, that Jesus was a refugee. And so they feel that they have a certain amount of commitment to live through their religious teaching, that they have to reach out to these people and bring them in and show them the love of Christ. And I think that's probably influenced a lot of it. Go back to our churches, that our churches in this country today have really, in many ways, betrayed us. It's sad. But I do have a question. Are the refugees, are they talking about Mexican refugees or refugees from the Middle East? You know,
I don't believe that Mexicans are called refugees because they're not fleeing any danger or oppression. They're just coming for economics. I think the definition of refugees, they have to come from a number of countries that has social turmoil and where these people are victims of that turmoil. So Mexico, I do not think applies. But in any event, Pastor Rob, you were talking about the religious beliefs that led this people to that direction. But I was just reading a history of my first ancestor that came over on the Johnson side, and it came over in 1630, settled in Roxbury, which was right next to Boston, or just 3 miles outside of Boston. And he came over. He was a hardcore Puritan, and everybody else that came over with him were hardcore Puritans. And boy, they wouldn't brook any of that stuff that's going on today. And if you can trace my line, they were hardcore Puritans. And I think Puritans kind of devolved into the Congregationalists. I think that's what it was, until they joined the Mormon Church, because the Mormons came along and they were hardcore than the Congregationalists were. And so you can see that religious fervor and strictness in my line, my Johnson line, all the way back for 13 generations, and even down to me. But so how did the Christian religion get so messed up where the Puritans used to hang and the Anne Hutchinsons because they didn't like them acting like a husband, you know, and they should be wives, or whatever it is? How did the Christian church get so lost? Who did that?
Who are you asking?
That's a long answer.
Well, was it? Was it? Was it Peel? What was it? Norman Vincent Peel? Was it?
I think we all have an inkling.
Can you read my book?
I think we all have.
You need to read my book, The Last Church.
Okay, let's go, Rachel, you first.
I'm just going to say, I think we all have an inkling that it has to do with the bringing together of Judaism and Christianity into the newfound American faith of Judaic Christianity, which is not Christianity. It's a hybrid religion that is taught in almost every church in America, Canada, all white nations, and it's really subverted our Christian faith. It has turned verses such as, you know, having love for your family and charity begins at home, and has subverted those things into the fact that we're supposed to have charity for everyone and let our home be the last site of refuge. We also have, you know, the invitation by American preachers of liberals from Frankfurt, Germany, and so forth after World War II into the American university system. And the ADL even published a fascinating paper back in the 1940s called ADL Facts, in which they pressured all their members to cozy up and go in league with newspaper editors, copy editors, school administrators, and on down the line, and to work with them to make sure that any anti-Jewish thought, idea, penmanship, or anything was eradicated out of the seminaries. And so we have generations of seminary students who have been brought up not in Christianity, but in Judeo-Christian ideology. And that ideology of Judaism is all about white genocide, all about mixing and crossing the color barrier and confusing our gender statuses in the world today.
Okay.
So that's my little tidbit.
Can you add to that, Pastor Rob?
Well, yes, the brotherhood of man and fatherhood of God is the foundation of most churches anymore. That we're all brothers in Christ, we're all brothers and sisters, we're all going to be in heaven together. So if we're going to be in heaven together, we might as well start getting along together with each other now. In 1958, in Dallas, Texas, the Dallas Morning News ran a full-page statement. It wasn't a petition, but a full-page statement signed by 359 ministers from Dallas and Fort Worth, which stated that they believed the integration of the schools and of the races was a sin. Now, that was in 1958. 359 ministers in Dallas and Fort Worth alone. You couldn't find 359 ministers in the entire country today to be willing to make that statement. It kind of goes back to what you said. It kind of goes back to what you said a little bit ago. They want to be popular. And who cares about these other issues? Who cares about just, I'm popular, I'm going to be well-received in my community, I'm going to be welcomed by the mayor's office and patted on the back, and people will say nice things about me, I'm a nice minister, I'm a nice Christian, I've got a nice suit, I've got a nice car, I take care of my wife, and everybody just loves me. So it's a very attractive thing to do. Being popular is a very attractive motivation for people.
Right, but you do have, even in the early settler days, you had a lot of fighting going on between the Indians and our colonists. In fact, my ancestor, Isaac Johnson, who was the second person to come, generation to come here, he was the first, he was killed in the first Great War in America, the Great Swamp Fight in the Massachusetts area. But there was battles going on. The Indians were attacking and causing all sorts of problems. But even while that was taking place, even at that early date, we were trying to convert them to Christianity. And I can tell you this, the Indians never once tried to convert my ancestors to the Cargill cult equivalent that they had. So even back then, that they were, you know, we had some real problems. But I think also they had not come in contact at that point with non-whites. This was the first time they encountered them, and so they were maybe didn't learn until a few generations that it's a bad thing to bring them into the fold.
That is one of the issues that I have with religion in general, is because it's not stable. They have absolutes like Pastor Rob was talking about back in the 50s, but those absolutes have inverted. The Southern Baptists, I think, just within the last year, the last convention, passed a resolution that endorsed, what do they call it, critical race theory. The exact opposite of what Pastor Rob was talking about. Okay, what are they going to do to the next generation? Well, we say there are absolutes, but I don't see any.
I'm waiting for Pastor Rob to change his position. He's going to say, okay, I've been wrong for 50 years, I'm going to change my view. Is that coming down the pipe?
It's a bad chance.
I don't see it coming. I don't see it coming. But I'm going to do a little promo here, okay, if I jump into this before the end. I read a book called The Last Church, and I think it'll be answer a lot of these questions. I don't know if I sent you a copy or not, Daniel, but if I have it, I'll send you one. And it goes in a lot of issues and how the Christian church is morphing into the one world church.
How can people order a copy of that book?
Oh, they can just write to me at Post Office Box 602, Harrison, Arkansas. P.O. Box 602, Harrison, Arkansas. I don't have any charge for it. Throw a few dollars in for a donation, I'll be out.
Okay, you guys, don't be penurious. Throw in more than a few dollars. You know, send them a bunch of money.
I will send you $1,000,000.
It's been very well received.
Fantastic. I'll be waiting for it.
Okay.
It's been very well received. A lot of people said that. One person wrote to me and said that he was a regular contributor to the Christian and Jewish United.